Argonautica by Apollonius Rhodius. Part 2 of Book 1. Now, when all things had been made ready by the thralls, all things that fully equipped ships are furnished withal, when men's business leads them to voyage across the sea, then the heroes took their way through the city to the ship, where it lay on the strand that men call Magnesian Pagasae. And a crowd of people hastening rushed together. But the heroes shone like gleaming stars among the clouds. And each man, as he saw them speeding along with their armor, would say, King Zeus, what is the purpose of Peleus? Whither is he driving forth from the Panachaean land so great a host of heroes? On one day they would waste the palace of Aeetes with baleful fire, should he not yield them the fleece of his own good will. But the path is not to be shunned. The toil is hard for those who venture. Thus they spake, here and there, throughout the city. But the women often raised their hands to the sky in prayer to the immortals to grant a return, their heart's desire. And one, with tears, thus lamented to her fellow, Wretched Alcimede! Evil has come to thee at last, though late. Thou hast not ended with splendor of life. Aeson, too, ill-fated man! Surely, better had it been for him if he were lying beneath the earth, enveloped in his shroud, still unconscious of bitter toils. Would that the dark wave, when the maiden Helle perished, had overwhelmed Phrixus too with the ram. But the dire portent even sent forth a human voice, that it might cause to Alcimede sorrows and countless pains hereafter. Thus the woman spoke at the departure of the heroes. And now many thralls, men and women, were gathered together. And his mother, smitten with grief for Jason. And a bitter pang seized every woman's heart, and with them groaned the father in baleful old age, lying on his bed, closely wrapped round. But the hero straightway soothed their pain, encouraging them, and bade the thralls take up his weapons for war. And they in silence, with downcast looks, took them up. And even as the mother had thrown her arms about her son, so she clung, weeping without stint, as a maiden all alone weeps, falling fondly on the neck of her hoary nurse, a maid who has now no others to care for her, but drags on a weary life under a stepmother who maltreats her continually with ever-fresh insults, and as she weeps, her heart within her is bound fast for misery. Nor can she sob forth all the groans that struggle for utterance. So, without stint, wept Alcimede, straining her son in her arms, and in her yearning grief spoke as follows. Would that on the day when, wretched woman that I am, I heard King Peleus proclaim his evil behest, I had straightway given up my life and forgotten my cares, so that thou thyself, my son, with thine own hands, might have buried me. For that was the only wish left me, still to be fulfilled by time. All the other rewards for thy nurture have I long enjoyed. Now I, once so admired among Achaean women, shall be left behind, like a bondwoman, in my empty halls, pining away, ill-fated one, for love of thee, thee on whose account I had aforetime so much splendor and renown. My only son, for whom I loosed my virgin zone, first and last. For to me beyond others the goddess Aletheia grudged abundant offspring. Alas for my folly! Not once, not even in my dreams, did I forebode this, that the flight of Phrixus would bring me woe. Thus with moaning she wept, and her handmaiden standing by lamented. But Jason spoke gently to her with comforting words. "Do not, I pray thee, mother, store up bitter sorrows overmuch, for thou wilt not redeem me from evil by tears, but wilt still add grief to grief. For unseen are the woes that the gods mete out to mortals. Be strong to endure thy share of them, though, with grief in thy heart. Take courage from the promises of Athena, and from the answers of the gods, for very favorable oracles has Phoebus given, and then from the help of the chieftains. But do thou remain here, quiet, among thy handmaids, and be not a bird of ill omen to the ship. And thither my clansmen and thralls will follow me." He spoke, and started forth to leave the house. And as Apollo goes forth from some fragrant shrine to divine Delos, or Claros, or Pytho, or to broad Lyia, near the stream of Xanthus, in such beauty moved Jason through the throng of people. And a cry arose as they shouted together. And there met him aged Iphias, priestess of Artemis, guardian of the city. And she kissed his right hand, but she had not strength to say a word for all her eagerness, as the crowd rushed on. But she was left there by the wayside, as the old are left by the young, and he passed on, and was gone afar. Now, when he had left the well-built streets of the city, he came to the beach of Pagase, where his comrades greeted him as they stayed together near the ship Argo. And he stood at the entering inn, and they were gathered to meet him. And they perceived Aiastus and Argus coming from the city. And they marveled when they saw them hasting with all speed, despite the will of Peleus. The one, Argus, son of Aristor, had cast round his shoulders the hide of a bull reaching to his feet, with the black hair upon it. The other, a fair mantle of double fold, which his sister Pelopia had given him. Still, Jason forbore from asking them about each point, but bade all to be seated for an assembly. And there, upon the folded sails and the mast as it lay on the ground, they all took their seats in order, and among them, with good will, spoke Aeson's son. "All the equipment that a ship needs for all is in due order, lies ready for our departure. Therefore we will make no long delay in our sailing for these things' sake, when the breezes but blow fair. But, friends, for common to all is our return to Hellas afterwards, and common to all is our path to the land of Aeetes. Now, therefore, with ungrudging heart, choose the bravest to be our leader, who shall be careful for everything, to take upon him our quarrels and covenants with strangers." Thus he spoke. And the young heroes turned their eyes toward bold Heracles sitting in their midst, and with one shout they all enjoined upon him to be their leader. But he, from the place where he sat, stretched forth his right hand and said, "Let no one offer this honor to me, for I will not consent. And I will forbid any other to stand up. Let the hero who brought us together himself be the leader of the host." Thus he spoke with high thoughts. And they assented, as Heracles bade. And warlike Jason himself rose up, glad at heart, and thus addressed the eager throng. "If you entrust your glory to my care, no longer as before, let our path be hindered. Now, at last, let us propitiate Phoebus with sacrifice, and straightway prepare a feast. And until my thralls come, the overseers of my steading, whose care it is to choose out oxen from the herd and drive them hither. We will drag down the ship to the sea. And do you place all the tackling within, and draw lots for the benches for rowing. Meantime, let us build upon the beach an altar to Apollo Ambasius, who, by an oracle, promised to point out and show me the paths of the sea, if by sacrifice to him I should begin my venture for King Peleus. He spoke, and was the first to turn to the work. And they stood up in obedience to him, and they heaped their garments one upon the other on a smooth stone which the sea did not strike with its waves. But the stormy surge had cleansed it long before. First of all, by the command of Argus, they strongly girded the ship with a rope well twisted within, stretching it tight on each side, in order that the planks might be well compacted by the bolts, and might withstand the opposing force of the surge. And they quickly dug a trench, as wide as the space the ship covered, and at the prow, as far into the sea as it would run when drawn down by their hands. And they ever dug deeper in front of the stem, and in the furrow laid polished rollers, and inclined the ship down upon the first rollers, that so she might glide and be borne upon them. And above, on both sides, reversing the oars, they fastened them round the thole pins, so as to project a cubit's space. And the heroes themselves stood on both sides at the oars, in a row, and pushed forward with chest and hand at once. And Tiphys leapt on board to urge the youths to push at the right moment. And calling on them, he shouted loudly, and they at once, leaning with all their strength, with one push started the ship from her place, and strained with their feet, forcing her onward. And Pelian Argo followed swiftly, and they on each side shouted as they rushed on. And then the rollers groaned under the sturdy keel as they were chafed, and round them rose up a dark smoke, owing to the weight, and she glided into the sea. But the hero stood there and kept dragging her back as she sped onward. And round the thole pins they fitted the oars, and in the ship they placed the mast and the well-made sails and the stores. Now, when they had carefully paid heed to everything, first they distributed the benches by lot, two men occupying one seat. But the middle bench they chose for Heracles and Ancaeus, apart from the other heroes, Ancaeus, who dwelt in Tegea. For them alone they left the middle bench just as it was, and not by lot, and with one consent they entrusted Tiphys with guarding the helm of the well-stemmed ship. Next, piling up shingle near the sea, they raised there an altar on the shore to Apollo, under the name of Actius and Ambasius, and quickly spread above it logs of dried olive wood. Meantime the herdsmen of Aeson's son had driven before them from the herd two steers. These the younger comrades dragged near the altars, and the others brought lustral water and barley meal. And Jason prayed, calling on Apollo, the god of his fathers. Hear, O king, that dwellest in Pagase and the city Aesonis, the city called by my father's name. Thou who didst promise me when I sought thy oracle at Pytho to show the fulfillment and goal of my journey. For thou thyself hast been the cause of my venture. Now do thou thyself guide the ship with my comrades safe and sound, thither and back again to Hellas. Then, in thy honour hereafter, we will lay again on thy altar the bright offerings of bulls, all of us who return. And other gifts in countless numbers I will bring to Pytho and Ortygia. And now come, Fardarter, accept this sacrifice at our hands, which first of all we have offered thee for this ship on our embarkation. And grant, O King, that with a prosperous weird I may loose the hawsers, relying on thy counsel. And may the breeze blow softly, with which we shall sail over the sea in fair weather." He spoke, and with his prayer cast the barley meal. And they too girded themselves to slay the steers, proud Ancaeus and Heracles. The latter, with his club, smote one steer mid-head on the brow, and falling in a heap on the spot, it sank to the ground. And Ancaeus struck the broad neck of the other with his axe of bronze, and shore through the mighty sinews, and it fell prone on both its horns. Their comrades quickly severed the victim's throats, and flayed the hides. They sundered the joints, and carved the flesh, then cut out the sacred thigh bones, and covering them all together closely with fat, burnt them upon cloven wood. And Aeson's son poured out pure libations, and Idmon rejoiced, beholding the flame as it gleamed on every side from the sacrifice, and the smoke of it mounting up with good omen in dark spiral columns. And quickly he spoke outright the will of Leto's son. "For you it is the will of heaven and destiny that you shall return here with the fleece. But meanwhile, both going and returning, countless trials await you. But it is my lot, by the hateful decree of a god, to die somewhere far off on the mainland of Asia. Thus, though I learnt my fate from evil omens even before now, I have left my fatherland to embark on the ship, that so, after my embarking, fair fame may be left me in my house." Thus he spoke, and the youths, hearing the divine utterance, rejoiced at their return. But grief seized them for the fate of Idmon. Now, at the hour when the sun passes his noontide halt, and the ploughlands are just being shadowed by the rocks, as the sun slopes toward the evening dusk, at that hour all the heroes spread leaves thickly upon the sand, and lay down in rows in front of the hoary surf-line. And near them were spread vast stores of viands and sweet wine, which the cup-bearers had drawn off in pitchers. Afterwards they told tales one to another in turn, such as youths often tell when at the feast and the bowl they take delightful pastime, and insatiable insolence is far away. But here the son of Aeson, all helpless, was brooding over each event in his mind, like one oppressed with thought. And Idas noted him, and assailed him with loud voice. "Son of Aeson, what is this plan thou art turning over in mind? Speak out thy thought in the midst. Does fear come on and master thee? Fear that confounds cowards? Be witness now my impetuous spear, wherewith in wars I win renown beyond all others. Nor does Zeus aid me so much as my own spear. That no woe will be fatal, no venture will be unachieved, while Idas follows, even though a god should oppose thee. Such a helpmeet am I, that thou bringest from Arene." He spoke, and holding a brimming goblet in both hands, drank off the unmixed sweet wine, and his lips and dark cheeks were drenched with it. And all the heroes clamored together, and Idmon spoke out openly, "Vain wretch, thou art devising destruction for thyself before thy time. Does the pure wine cause thy bold heart to swell in thy breast to thy ruin? And has it set thee on to dishonor the gods? Other words of comfort there are with which a man might encourage his comrade, but thou hast spoken with utter recklessness. Such taunts, the tale goes, did the sons of Eloeus once blurt out against the blessed gods, and thou dost nowise equal them in valor. Nevertheless, they were both slain by the swift arrows of Leto's son, mighty though they were." Thus he spoke, and Afare and Idas, laughed out loud and long, and eyeing him askance, replied with biting words, "Come now, tell me this by thy prophetic art, whether for me too the gods will bring to pass such doom as thy father promised for the sons of Aloeus. And bethink thee how thou wilt escape from my hands alive, if thou art caught making a prophecy vain as the idle wind." Thus in wrath Idas reviled him, and the strife would have gone further, had not their comrades, and Aeson's son himself, with indignant cry, restrained the contending chiefs. And Orpheus lifted his lyre in his left hand, and made assay to sing. He sang how the earth, the heaven, and the sea once mingled together in one form, after deadly strife were separated each from other, and how the stars and the moon and the paths of the sun ever keep their fixed place in the sky, and how the mountains rose, and how the resounding rivers with their nymphs came into being, and all creeping things. And he sang how first of all Ophion and Eurynome, daughter of Ocean, held the sway of snowy Olympus, and how, through strength of arm, one yielded his prerogative to Kronos and the other to Rhea, and how they fell into the waves of Ocean. But the other two, meanwhile, ruled over the blessed Titan gods, while Zeus, still a child and with the thoughts of a child, dwelt in the Dectaean cave. And the earth-born Cyclopes had not yet armed him with the bolt, with thunder and lightning, for these things give renown to Zeus. He ended, and stayed his lyre and divine voice. But though he had ceased, they still bent forward with eagerness, all hushed to quiet, with ears intent on the enchanting strain. Such a charm of song had he left behind in their hearts. Not long after, they mixed libations in honor of Zeus, with pious rites, as is customary, and poured them upon the burning tongues, and bethought them of sleep in the darkness. Note: Apollo Embasius is the god of embarkation. Apollo Actius is the god of the shore. End of part 2 of book 1.